Jesus Christ. I've been looking forward to seeing this debate for quite some time. I can only conclude that William Lane Craig just completely owned Richard Carrier.
Okay. Right.
Welcome to Reasonable Faith, Conversations with William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and we hope you'll find the topics we discuss enriching and enlightening concerning the big questions of life. Dr. William Lane Craig is a noted philosopher and theologian known for his work on the existence of God, philosophy of time, and the resurrection of Jesus. And we invite you to discover the wealth of resources at reasonablefaith.org. There you'll find Dr. Craig's famous debates with leading atheists, articles, books, podcasts, audio from Dr. Craig's Defenders class, and a question and answer section featuring amazing questions people send us and answers from Dr. Craig. That's reasonablefaith.org, reasonablefaith.org. Dr. Craig, let's discuss a debate that generated a lot of buzz, and I think that the reason this debate generated so much talk is because many people have been anticipating an exchange between you and an atheist named Richard Carrier. This was a debate on the resurrection. A little background on Richard, we'll give that here in just a moment. But Bill, I want to ask you, why do you think there was a lot of talk about this particular debate? It was rather anticipated.
It really was. There was a lot of excitement going into the debate. And I think it's because of Richard's prominence in the whole internet infidel network. And for many people, I think he was the sort of great white hope, which was going to come along and really bring down the case for the resurrection of Jesus, who was going to defeat it soundly and show its fallacies. So a lot of people were really pinning their hopes, I think, on Richard Carrier.
The internet infidels, also known as the secular web, one of the first secular, atheist, naturalistic websites, and still very large. At one point, I think it was number one as far as visitors there and interaction. Mm. And they try to do a good job as far as presenting an atheistic or naturalistic point of view.
Yes.
A lot of material about you there. They interact with it and so on. So I'll just concur with you. There was a lot of talk about this debate because of Richard Carrier, and he has a lot of fans, and he calls them his fans.
Yes, I find that rather odd, but you're quite right. It's Richard Carrier fans that I find strange. I mean, I don't think, for example, that I have fans. I have students, but not fans, and so I find that rather odd.
And whether he means it in a facetious way or he's actually thanking his fans, I don't know, but he does have a following, and from what I've been able to see, a rather young following. Hmm. Now, that's why I thought this, one of the reasons I thought that this debate was going to be important.
I felt that the debate went very well from the Christian point of view. I don't think that Richard came to grips with any of the four facts that I presented on behalf of the resurrection. He tried to argue in terms of broad generalities rather than grappling with the specifics. Not only with those specific four facts, but with the supporting lines of evidence in support of each of these facts. And then with regard to naturalistic explanations, again, it would be very broad brushstrokes, like that the disciples were prone to hallucinations, and therefore Paul was schizophrenic and Mary was a psychotic, and this explains everything. There was no detailed defense of these naturalistic explanations in terms of the criteria that I was using to assess them, such as explanatory scope, explanatory power, plausibility, degree of ad hocness, and so forth. So I felt there was a failure on his part to come to grips with specifics in an effective way. And so I'm hoping that as a result of this debate, that many people who had great confidence in Richard Carrier's attacks will think again and say, wait a minute, maybe the evidence for this event is much more powerful than I thought, and maybe there's a reason why Richard Carrier finds himself amidst that minority of scholars who deny these facts.
I might mention as well is that Richard Carrier was a contributor to a book called The Empty Tomb.
Yes.
And it was supposed to be the secular answer to all the evidence for the resurrection. What puzzles me is that Richard Carrier has studied you for a long time and written on you for a long time.
He was very familiar with your 4 points, yet he just didn't seem to address them.
Yes, this is what shocked me as well, Kevin. I was anticipating that since my material has been out there for years, that when Richard Carrier got up to speak in his opening address, there would be a point-for-point parrying of the evidence that I laid out for my case. And instead, there were just generalities about the Gospels being myths, rather than coming to grips with the 4 facts that I would present. In fact, the fact of the burial of Jesus by Joseph of Arimathea was never even touched in the debate by Richard, even though that was the first of my 4 facts that needed to be explained, and the first of my lines of evidence in favor of the empty tomb, that if the burial account is accurate, then the site of Jesus' grave was known in Jerusalem to both Jew and Christian alike, and it would be impossible for a movement founded on the belief in the resurrection of the dead man to arise and flourish in a city where the location of his body was public knowledge. And yet, Richard never engaged at all with the burial account, and only later in the debate did he begin to engage with the empty tomb and the origin of the Christian faith and so forth.
It's my understanding that he really didn't want to debate the resurrection when arrangements for this were being made.
That's right. He said, I'm not going to debate the resurrection of Jesus. What I want to debate is the historical reliability of the Gospels. And it seemed to me that that was just an unmanageable topic. I mean, imagine just trying to debate the single subject of the historical reliability of the Gospel of Luke. Just that topic alone. Yeah. And then pull in the other synoptics. And then pull in John, and you can see you just have an impossible topic for a 90-minute debate. So I said, no, I want to focus on a specific event in the Gospels, namely the resurrection of Jesus. And Richard agreed, all right, we'll do that. We'll talk about the resurrection. And therefore, I was so surprised in his opening statement when he got up to speak, and what did he do? He launched into a general attack upon the reliability of the Gospels, claiming they're mythical and giving examples of things in the Gospels that he thought were just symbolical and not meant to be historical, rather than coming to grips with the 4 facts that I claim undergird the inference to Jesus' resurrection.
Looking over Richard Carrier's material before the debate, do you get the impression that he thinks that Christ is not historical, that Jesus didn't actually exist?
Well, that is his most recent position. Much of his material was published before he came to this view of a purely mythical Jesus. So, for example, in one of his articles that he published criticizing me, he makes a statement that few people would deny that there is a historical core concerning Jesus of Nazareth and the people and characters about him that can be profitably mined by the historian for genuine historical information about Jesus. And the point that I was making in the debate, that part of that historical core that is recognized by the majority of New Testament historians today are facts like the burial in the tomb, the discovery of the empty tomb, the postmortem appearances of Jesus, and the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. Those are part of that historical core that Richard admits most scholars recognize. But now he has moved away from believing that even there is a historical core, and he thinks it's all purely mythological and symbolical.
Many of us anticipated that Richard Carrier would talk about Paul's view of the resurrection body. Did he go that direction?
No, he did not in the debate. This is the centerpiece of his argument in the book, The Empty Tomb. And it's interesting, Kevin, because listeners may not be aware of the fact that this is actually a very old strategy that is characteristic of mid-20th century Protestant liberalism with respect to the resurrection. Protestant liberals could not believe in the literal physical resurrection of Jesus because it's a nature miracle, and liberal Protestants just couldn't swallow miracles. So what they wanted to argue was that the resurrection of Jesus, though a real event, was a non-physical event. Jesus rose spiritually from the dead while his corpse rotted away in the tomb. And the disciples then had visions, spiritual, non-physical visions of Jesus. And this enabled Protestant liberals to affirm the historicity of Jesus' resurrection, but denying the empty tomb and the physical postmortem appearances of Jesus. And the strategy of these Protestant liberals was to drive a wedge between Paul and the Gospels. The strategy was to say that Paul believed in a purely spiritual resurrection, not a physical resurrection, and moreover, that Paul's information is the earliest we have and therefore represents primitive, original Christianity, and that the Gospels came along much later and represent a legendary, later redacted, theologically reflected kind of Christianity rather than the original Christian belief. And now what's happened is that Carrier, from a naturalistic point of view, adopts the same strategy that these Protestant liberals adopted and tries to employ it to show that, in fact, Christianity is just a myth, that it really isn't true at all, that Jesus isn't risen from the dead, that as naturalists we should think that all of this is just legendary and mythological. But the strategy is the same as these liberals in the mid-20th century. Now, what he doesn't recognize is that this traditional liberal strategy came under sustained and overwhelming criticism in the latter half of the second part of the 20th century, so that today the wide majority of commentators on Paul's theology agree, first of all, that when Paul talks about a spiritual body, he's not talking about the substance of the body. He's talking about its orientation. The body is spiritual in the sense that we say the Bible is a spiritual book, or Billy Graham is a spiritual man. We don't mean that they are some sort of invisible, intangible, unextended thing made out of spirit. We're talking about the orientation or character of these
things.
Yeah,
you can pick the Bible up. Your hand will not go through it.
Right.
You can shake Billy Graham's hand.
That's right. He's not like Casper the Ghost, which is the analogy that Richard used to describe Paul's doctrine of the resurrection body, that it's like Casper the Ghost, which is just crazy.
And he claims that Paul actually used language to indicate this. I mean, he tries to go to 1 Corinthians 15 and show that Paul...
Yes, he tries to use Paul's expression, spiritual body, to interpret it that way. Well, the problem is Paul uses the same language, Kevin, in the same letter in 1 Corinthians in chapter 2 to talk about the contrast between the natural man and the spiritual man. And obviously, by the spiritual man, Paul doesn't mean the immaterial, massless, unextended man. He's talking about people who are filled with the Holy Spirit and under the direction and control of God's Spirit. The contrast between the natural man and the spiritual man is not one of substance, but of orientation. And the same is true of the contrast between the natural body and the spiritual body in 1 Corinthians 15. And as I say, this is what most commentators think. The other thing that most commentators came to recognize is that Paul believed in a transformation of the earthly body to the resurrection body, that the way the resurrection comes to be is through a transformation of the remains of the earthly body, not an exchange of one body for another different, numerically non-identical body. And therefore, Paul most definitely would believe in the empty tomb. He would think the graves would be empty when the resurrection occurs. But Richard, as I say, doesn't take any cognizance whatsoever of this sustained criticism of the old Protestant liberalism, which he, in effect, is still espousing.
Bill, this strategy of saying, no, Paul believed and the disciples believed in a spiritual resurrection. The body did rot away in the tomb. It was a spiritual resurrection and all that. You still get somewhat of a resurrection there, but it erodes the case for Christ, it seems, in that they want to back you away from showing historical evidence and say,
I think that what Richard would say to the Protestant liberal who claims, yes, I do believe in the resurrection, I believe he's spiritually risen, Richard will then use his naturalism to say, well, wait a minute, which is more probable, that there were hallucinations and maybe theft of the body or relocation of the body, or to believe that there is this immaterial supernatural event that you talk about. And he will say it's far more plausible and probable to think that these were just hallucinations or something.
In other words, if you can get people of faith, if you can get Christians to accept that it was merely a spiritual resurrection, immaterial, non-corporeal resurrection, and Jesus' body was rotting away in the tomb all along, you have taken them in a step away from the Christian faith.
Oh, yes, quite definitely. And Richard will then say, you no longer have any reason then to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Why believe in this invisible spiritual resurrection?
This is what is disturbing to me, Bill. Hmm. Let me chase this for just a moment. I'm afraid that many Christians sitting in our pews today don't understand the bodily nature of Christ's resurrection. They are happy to think that it was an immaterial, incorporeal body, and it was just kind of a specter of him. Hmm. And they go to John 20, where Jesus said, "Don't touch me, because I've not yet ascended to the Father." And misunderstanding that verse, which we'll talk about it another time, misunderstanding that, they think that you weren't supposed to touch him because he was not material.
Oh, and that's absurd. I mean, John has the physical demonstrations of showing the hands and inviting Thomas to put his finger in the wounds, and Jesus eating fish with the disciples. Clearly, John believed in a physical resurrection body. In fact, it's unanimous in the Gospels that all of the Gospel appearance stories presuppose a physical, tangible resurrection body of Jesus.
So our listeners need to understand that. Bodily resurrection.
And not just bodily, ironically enough, Kevin. Physical. Okay. A physical body, not some sort of ectoplasmic spiritual body, but a tangible, material, physical resurrection body in which Jesus rose.
A quick objection that I hear coming up, well, what about a person who's burned and there's nothing but ashes left, or there's a person lost at sea and there's just not anything left of that body? Is God going to be able, in all his power,
right,
which is ironic, to pull those molecules back together?
Well, the original Jewish belief in resurrection, interestingly enough, was not the resurrection of the flesh. Jews, in their funerary practices, would allow the body to decompose for a year until the flesh was rotted away. Then they would collect the bones and put them in boxes called ossuaries to be preserved for the resurrection. So actually, in Jewish belief, it was the bones that were the primary object of the resurrection. And you see this used symbolically in Ezekiel chapter 37, where the prophet is shown the valley of dry bones. Do you remember? And he says, "Will these bones live again?" And Ezekiel says, "Lord, thou knowest." And then he has a vision of how the bones are assembled and clothed with sinews and then flesh, and then they become alive. That's a Jewish picture of the resurrection. It's the bones that are the primary object. Now, the Jews, in handling the case of Jewish martyrs, where even the bones might be destroyed, knew that God in his power could create a new body out of nothing for those who had all earthly remains destroyed, and that in that case, there are no remains of the body left, and so God will create a new body for them simply out of nothing or out of anything. But so long as there were remains, particularly the bones, those would be the principal object of the resurrection.
Bill, we want to do a part two on this because we're about out of time, because there's going to be a lot of evaluation and commentary that usually occurs after the debate. So right. We anticipate a lot of that, and a lot of tongues will wag, and the blogosphere will be ablaze. So we want to talk about some of the things that may occur. Let me mention this in closing. There will be some sour grapes as well, I think, among those who just admit that Richard Carrier lost this debate and that his arguments don't stand up to the evidence for the resurrection. And what do you say to those people who just want a grudge match?
I want to say emphatically is that if Richard Carrier did lose this debate, he did not lose it because of rhetorical tricks on my part. He lost it because his arguments were weak and he could not respond effectively to the evidence. This debate was not won or lost on the basis of rhetoric or clever debating tactics. He simply did not come to grips with the evidence, nor did he offer and sustain effective objections. And so I just want to insist on the argumentative content of the debate, and I think that there the Christian side clearly had the superior argument.
Thank you, Dr. Craig, for spending some time with us, and thank you, the listener, for being here today. This podcast is available at reasonablefaith.org, as well as a wealth of audio, video, and written materials from William Lane Craig. People all over the world have benefited from the insights of Dr. Craig, and we invite you to browse our resources at reasonablefaith.org. And when you give to Reasonable Faith or purchase our resources, you help us expand into more media and speaking events, taking Christ to a world of big questions. So be sure and visit us at reasonablefaith.org. I'm Kevin Harris. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with William Lane Craig.